You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome into a special Thursday night edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. Now, you may be asking what my Jewish brethren ask every Passover. Why is this night different than all other nights? And it's because we have our second ever guest. That's right, Ben Nadeau joins the Locked On Nets podcast. Ben is currently a writer for B-Ball Insiders, but he got his start with a site Nets fans should be intimately familiar with from 2012 to 2017, a writer and then editor at the BK Game. I know for a fact that's one of my go-to sites for Nets news and analysis. So having an esteemed guest such as Ben, we took the opportunity to ask him some of our biggest questions from the Nets season so far, such as what he thought of D'Angelo Russell's play before he got hurt, whether he feels Spencer Dinwiddie's jump is sustainable, would he like a mulligan on the Allen Crabbe trade, and finally we managed to pry a couple of great Brook Lopez stories out of him. So I'll stop delaying the inevitable. Without further ado, Ben Nadeau.
Welcome in Ben Nadeau, a writer at Basketball Insider, formerly of the Brooklyn Game. And Ben, we really appreciate you coming on.
Of course. I'm excited to be here with you guys.
Yeah, so a big Nets head like the two of us. Ben, I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you grew up or at the very least went to college in Boston. How did you become a Nets fan?
Yeah, so I went to college in Boston, but before that, I grew up in Portland, Maine. My dad was a big-time Celtics fan, but for some reason, I did not like Paul Pierce or Antoine Walker. So when I was getting into basketball, I decided that I didn't want to be a Celtics fan. So naturally, the next closest team to Boston was the New York Knicks, and at that time in my childhood, the only team that I was a super big fan of at that point was the Red Sox, so obviously that's Yankee territory, and I couldn't do that. So next closest to that was the New Jersey Nets, and played basketball at the time, so I really fell in love with Jason Kidd and his pass-first style of play, and the rest is history.
Yeah, Ben, I have to say that your Paul Pierce suspicions were completely correct.
Yeah, of course they would trade for Pierce and then move to New York, so that just worked out perfectly for me.
Yeah, I'm sure the last few years must have been pretty rough for you with family in Boston.
Yeah, mostly coworkers, friends back home that would text me all the time saying thank you for the pick. You know, you do get used to it.
Mm-hmm. It's eventually our duty as Nets fans.
Yeah, and after a while you get so hardened about it that you're like, look, I don't know what you want me to say. It wasn't my fault. I didn't trade those picks, so you're not going to get anything else out of me. But I think writing and covering the Nets and being a longtime fan of them even before they did that trade really strengthens you to the hardships of sports. So I have to thank the Nets for a lot of the things that they've done for me emotionally and mentally over the years.
No, yeah, I completely agree with that. I think that C.J. Watson's missed dunk in the playoffs is actually a more heartbreaking experience for me than the stuff we went through with the Celtics the last few years. But any Net fan knows you from your time at the BK Game. You did great work there. So what's it kind of been like transitioning to covering the league from a national standpoint?
Oh, man, it's been completely different. I mean, I was obviously very blessed to take over the BK Game from Devin Carpernian, who pretty much taught me everything about sports blogging that I know. But it was tough to do it from so far away. Even all my writers on the team were New York based, so I never saw anybody. I never went to any games. But being in Boston, I currently live only 5 minutes from the Garden. So although it's been different for me coming to the reality that I can't walk to the arena without a coat anymore now that it's 22 degrees out and almost Christmas, it's been an absolute treat to do the whole locker room thing, interview guys, do more feature pieces instead of just breaking news coverage and game recaps and stuff like that. So it's been an absolute blast.
All right, so to kind of flip that question on its heel, what do you miss most about just covering the Nets? Because I find, or at least like when I've covered the Suns for a while and now covering the Nets full time, it's even when you're not doing it on a day-to-day basis, you almost form relationships with guys just from watching the same team night in and night out, and you really get attached. So did you find that, or what specifically did you miss about covering one team?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I went over it. I've obviously got a special connection with the Nets, but it's not a complaint or anything like that, but when teams come to town, I usually spend time in the visiting locker room as opposed to with all the local media with the Celtics trying to do their usual daily coverage. You know, there's a lot of research that goes into coming up with interview questions. Like yesterday, I talked to Luke Kennard, which was a lot of fun, but admittedly, I hadn't followed much of his rookie year yet. Whereas when the Nets come to Boston, which is not until January, I feel like I'm going to be able to step into that locker room and maybe talk to every single one of them if I wanted to, just from watching the games in all my spare time and knowing where they've come from and what their development over the years has looked like, good and bad. So just kind of adapting to covering the league on a day-to-day basis where each night you're talking to new people and writing about new teams, that's been a whole different experience for me.
Yeah, and just to give a little color for our listeners, Ben and the BK Game team literally did game grades for every single player, for almost every player for every game. So that, I'm sure that must have been a huge adjustment to kind of speaking with players every once in a while now. So what has been your perspective on the Nets this season? Kind of 7-13, obviously dealt with some injuries this year. But I think things have been going pretty smoothly, but I'm excited to hear your take about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm obviously a little less connected than I have in years past, but today, just before the podcast, I was watching the Nets-Rockets game from last night, trying to just catch up any way I can. I think that there's little to complain about thus far with the Nets, given the injuries, and we did this last year when Lynn got hurt, and all of a sudden we were down to Isaiah Whitehead and Kilpatrick playing point guard. So thank God for Spencer Dinwiddie's kind of coming out party all of a sudden, or we'd be in the same exact situation. But given all that and kind of the first year adjustments without Brooke Lopez, 7-13 is good. And of course, in the Eastern Conference, that's only 3.5 games out of the playoffs right now, I think. So there's plenty of time for them to kind of figure it out. Even outside of Lynn and Russell, obviously, you know, Booker's missed time, Rondé's missed time, Crabbe has missed time. If they ever get a period of a big stretch of games where all those guys are healthy, I think you'll really be able to see what Atkinson can do. But those Lynn and Russell injuries so early are killer.
Yeah. No, you mentioned Spencer Dinwiddie kind of saving the day. I remember, I guess at this time last year in the before podcast era for myself, I think I tweeted at you when I was just a measly fan saying that, what do the Nets see in Dinwiddie? We should have kept Yogi Ferrell.
Wow, you really look down on fans, Josh. That's telling.
Now I'm in the media. I have to hold myself in a higher esteem.
Yeah, I haven't looked back at my old tweets. I probably should. I think I was probably on the Yogi Ferrell bandwagon, which is, to be fair, the wagon that most people were on, I think. And not to say that Ferrell hasn't done well in Dallas, even outside of that really torridly hot stretch that he had once he joined the Mavericks. But I don't think there's a single person now, although your revisionist history would be helpful in that, that would rather have Yogi over Dinwiddie at this point. It's kind of remarkable. I don't know if that was dumb luck on Sean Marks's part, but it has worked out so impressively.
Yeah, I spend an uncomfortable amount of time thinking about that, probably too much time with the Nets in general. But I find it kind of amazing when you compare what the Nets have done with those fringe free agency guys versus a team like the Sixers, who was essentially cycling through these guys for 3 years. And you could argue Robert Covington. I mean, there were a couple other guys that are still on the team, like TJ McConnell and Solid, but Robert Covington was really the only great find. And it seems like the Nets just like pulled all these guys out of nowhere. Dinwiddie being the obvious one, but Joe Harris, Trevor Booker to a lesser degree, because he was kind of a known entity as an NBA guy. But I just wanted to ask you, obviously no one totally saw what Spencer Dinwiddie is doing now as I mean, I don't think anyone was projecting it, but how sustainable do you think it is? Because he's playing like, it's like, it would be a stretch to say like a star level, but he's kind of filling that role for the Nets and doing a pretty darn good job at it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to try and predict how sustainable it is, just because that we've never seen this kind of stretch of good basketball from him before, but he plays really intelligently. He takes advantage of his size when he can. He's got one of the best, if not the best, I can't remember exactly, assist to turnover ratios in the league. And that alone, even if he's not scorching hot from deep or putting up 25-point nights, that's the kind of game manager role, like you said, that the Nets will need him to be all season long. So I don't know if he'll put up these so-called star numbers that you were talking about every night, but as a veteran, I guess he's a veteran at this point guard that takes care of the ball and makes sure the Nets aren't crumbling at every given opportunity, there's no reason why he can't do that for the rest of the year.
All right, so kind of given how well he's playing, the Nets, even though they've lost, I think now three of their last four, maybe four of their last five, they played essentially as well as they were with D'Angelo Russell running the point. What did you think about his performance before he got hurt, and how much do you read into the fact that the team has been roughly as good without him?
I don't know if I read into it too much at all, but I was very excited to get a glimpse at Russell when he was still playing every night. I don't know how far back you guys go with the Nets, but they've had some terrible luck with point guards pretty much since Jason Kidd left. And although Brook Lopez was Mr. Reliable and exciting in his own right, especially when he learned how to develop that three-point shot, there's something about watching an electric point guard that has the potential to be a superstar in this league that was just so entrancing, even when he wasn't shooting well. As for reading into their record with or without Russell, that's kind of tough just because they have dealt with so many injuries across the board at so many positions, and they haven't had a large opportunity to have a lot of continuity. But between Lynn's injury and kind of not knowing what you're going to get out of Crab every single night, I think that the guys that have been left have done a great job to step up and work hard, but I think they'd probably be doing a little bit better at this point, especially with Dinwiddie's continued emergence, if they had Russell alongside him in the backcourt.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's something that we do this podcast 3 to 5 times a week, and it's something we constantly go back and forth on, particularly when D'Angelo Russell was playing and kind of debating his play. Because I think, Josh, I think I maybe have been a little bit higher on him than you have, but we've both kind of come to the consensus that he was, like, it was obviously talented as an individual scorer and creator, and, like, far and away, especially with Jeremy Lin out, the best guy in those areas on this Nets team. But at the same time, like, he hijacked possessions, and, like, there were elements of it that were counterproductive. But then you remember that he's 21, and you feel like you're reading way, way too much into it. But I think it does say something that the ball movement has kind of gotten back to, like, its early season peak with him out. Josh, I mean, was that fair?
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with expectations. I mean, D'Angelo Russell's extremely highly touted player, former number 2 overall pick. And then when you're comparing him with Spencer Dinwiddie, a guy that a lot of people wrote off after he tore his ACL at Colorado, took him a while bouncing around Detroit and Chicago to finally stick with the Nets. And I think a lot of fans find it refreshing that he's moving the ball and playing within himself, as Ben mentioned. But I think, you know, D'Angelo Russell is such a talented player, and I think he really put up great stats this season so far, and better than anyone could have expected. So you have to be happy with his performance, obviously, even though it doesn't translate to wins. That's going to come over time. And then especially comparing a guy like Dinwiddie to the opposite, Sean Kilpatrick, who's playing right now and been forced in the rotation. Ben, I know you have some thoughts on Kilpatrick.
Or at least when he arrived, I was a big Kilpatrick fan, especially as the first move as the Sean Marks era as GM. But I don't know what's going on with him this year. I know he's very out of the rotation at the beginning of the year, so he's kind of forcing shots up when he does get on the floor. But it's his game hasn't changed all that much, but he feels like a completely different player when I watch him now. And I don't know if it's a confidence thing, or like I said, if he feels like he needs to force the issue when he does get on the court. But I know Twitter, fairly or unfairly, has kind of called for the end of Sean Kilpatrick in Brooklyn. I was wondering what you guys were thinking about that, but in a season like this where there are no playoff expectations at this point, I think it's fair to say if cutting Kilpatrick loose at this point is really the good thing or the right thing, the wrong thing. I know Milton Doyle has a lot of fans out there. I've certainly been disappointed with Kilpatrick, but I don't know if it's time to give up on him quite yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like Kilpatrick. I like his hashtag undrafted shtick. It's kind of like a WWE persona for him. But he just looks so out of place on this roster. I think he might be a better fit on a team like even like Detroit or someone where there's not really a ton of ball movement and he can just kind of gun up shots and they need someone to create any sort of possession that can kind of result in some sort of points. But on this Nets team where there's all this ball movement, he just looks so out of place. There's one time yesterday, I think, in Houston's game where he just was driving the ball up court, kind of was at the 20-foot foot mark, was looking around for someone to pass to, and then said, hey, you know what, I'll just dribble back out and take a contested three-pointer, which resulted in an air ball. So I think he needs a fresh start. I know Sean Marks probably was pinning a lot of hopes on him as sort of the signal of that new regime as being the first signing. But I think it could be time to cut bait. I don't know if they'll get someone that can replace him talent-wise, but it's worth a shot at this point. Just throw something at the wall and see what sticks.
You know, Josh, I disagree with you a little bit, like under the premise that is reality, that D'Angelo Russell and Jeremy Lin are out. I think they need that extra guy that can just do stuff with the ball, and he's not by any means a clean fit with the way they want to play. And it's really tough to ask a guy that plays his style of basketball to come out for 5 minutes at a time and do what he does and be in rhythm right away and play efficiently and then go back to the bench and maybe come back for another 5 minutes in the third quarter and then sit out the entire fourth. But I just think they need that extra bit of juice. And with all the different injuries they're dealing with right now, Josh, I think we'll get into this at some point when we're talking about the last two games. But, I mean, they're essentially missing, you could argue, their five most important pieces coming into the season. Right now, I just think they need all the depth they can, and they can't necessarily afford to give a guy like that up. But, Ben, I wanted to kind of, while we're on the topic of moving guys, I wanted to get the bigger picture view from you on that point. What do you think Sean Marks' mentality will be at the trade deadline, and are there any tangential guys that you're looking for him to potentially deal?
Yeah, I think I go back and forth on this one, but I think he'll probably be a seller come the winter. At least he'll do his due diligence as someone like Sean Marks does. I mean, coming into this year, I was pretty surprised that the majority of the roster did come back, including both Joe Harris and Sean Kilpatrick, since they're kind of similar players. But even though continuity and culture are those big buzzwords that Sean Marks and Kenny Atkinson have been preaching over the last however many months, I think if you can get any kind of asset out of someone like Trevor Booker, who will probably be the most appealing player on the Nets at this point, you have to do it, right? I mean, Joe Harris has improved enough with all these injuries and his extra minutes that someone could come calling for him. But it'll probably be Booker, I would imagine, that would go. And I am a Booker guy. I think he brings a lot of that important energy and hustle and you know, that other hashtag word that they love to use, grit, off the bench. But if he can get an asset, whether it is just... right?
Yeah, I think that you make a logical point, but at the same time, as you mentioned, Booker really does personify what they're trying to build, and I think it's just hilarious that he's kind of become like such an important part of the team, and I love seeing him kind of get the ball and just in the post call off people, and he'll try to post up anyone, like even if he was posting up Yusuf Nurkic, and Nurkic has like 4 inches and like 40 pounds on him at least, and he was just like no regard for it, just going for it full throttle like he always does, complaining after every call. I think he's just a hilarious player, and I would be sad to see him on another team, but I think, as you mentioned, it kind of might make sense to recoup any sort of value. You talked about some of those buzzwords, grit, culture. For me as a fan, those kind of ring a little bit hollow, I've always thought, in the Sean Marks era, obviously coming from that Billy King regime, where that was not present whatsoever. Like, what did you think of Sean Marks and Kenny Atkinson consistently preaching that culture, that grit? And like, how did you feel about that when you covered the team?
I mean, I personally enjoyed it at the beginning just because I was tired of seeing this roster turnover almost completely year after year outside of Brook Lopez. You know, could spend an entire hour on this podcast running through the names of people that kind of came and went and maybe loafed through games here and there, spent a little too much time injured, cared more about money than winning. But it was kind of refreshing to see these new guys come in and be the exact opposite of Billy King, which obviously wasn't a very hard thing to do. I'll admit their external marketing campaigns haven't kind of helped make that seem more genuine. Because it's Brooklyn grit this year, right? Or was that last year?
Grit and this that, year.
Yeah, I don't buy that as much as a selling point for fans to get them in the arena and all that. But I think internally, as you grow that culture and you don't have that skill level or talent or up-and-coming hot prospect that all these other rebuilding teams have, you do have to rely on hustle and grit as much as those are just buzzwords to a lot of people to prove that you are a team worth watching, to prove that you are a potential free agency destination. And Atkinson has done a really good job of instilling those qualities into the team. So I buy into that, but just not as much the whole marketing campaign behind it.
Yeah, I think I'm just numb as a longtime fan. I'm just numb to any sort of marketing campaign put out there by the Nets. Just going back to when they were at the Prudential Center and they would sell the Nets jerseys, and it was a reversible inside out with like a LeBron or a Kobe jersey. And
was that a real thing?
That was a real thing.
Oh wow, that's pretty bad.
Came with a ticket plan, right?
Yeah, you know, they just threw everything at you and said, "Here you go."
That's pretty good. I don't know. I think I lean more towards Ben's side in this conversation because, like to give them credit, like this team has consistently played their asses off, and that's with all the injuries and even the last two nights when guys were out. Like last night, they were basically down to their second string, playing arguably the best team in the NBA through however many games, 18 games, and they cut into a massive deficit. And then you have the Cavs game, you have the Warriors game, where again, down substantially to the Warriors and playing against a pissed off LeBron in Cleveland, and they made it close both times. I think that stuff kind of rings true. And the other reason I kind of buy into it is because the big emphasis is skill development. And I think you really see that in these guys. And Ben, you were talking about how they could potentially trade someone like Joe Harris. And I think that's just a testament to Kenny Atkinson, like beyond the fact that he's turned him into a useful piece of this team. He's arguably turned him from a guy who was on the fringe of the NBA into an asset. So I guess for those reasons, I'm less destroyed by it than you guys are.
Yeah, I know. I think it's fair. It's just I want to see wins, you know? Like, my 7th grade youth team had a lot of culture, but at the same time, you want to see talent on the floor. And I think that 2 years from now, if they're still pushing this grit thing and Rhonda Hollis-Jefferson, Caris LeVert, those guys haven't really turned into anything and they're just kind of banking on winning the lottery in 2020 and there's really no progress, then I'm going to be pissed off. But, you know, it all comes down to wins on the court. And if we see some progress, then I can make an exception for the kind of the played out Brooklyn grit hashtag.
Yeah, it's difficult because you have to obviously remember that they've pushed these slogans with the idea that they would have their starting point guard and Jeremy Lin on the court for the majority of the season. And once he's gone down now 2 years in a row, all of those plans have mostly gone out the window and they're reduced to just playing hard, which, as you were saying, goes a long way and is impressive at times, but doesn't translate to wins. So I think I'm probably somewhere in the middle on that one. If it is 2020 and we're stuck in the same spot, yeah, that'll be a little bit annoying. But for what they've dealt with and what they have in their hand right now, it's pretty good, all things considered.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's a good point. Definitely, we have to look at this kind of as in the big picture, not really day by day, because the losses can get frustrating and pile up. But when you look at the job Markson and Atkinson have done in the 2 years they've taken over, or one, I guess 1 year and change for Kenny, but it's been a good job. So we're going to get into some quick hitters right now. Ben, anyone that follows you on Twitter knows you're a huge soccer fan. We're going to start out. Luka Doncic or Christian Pulisic, who is more of an icon?
Wow, I was not prepared for that one. I think it's got to be Pulisic, just because he's carrying the hopes of American soccer on his shoulders. And although USA didn't make the World Cup, which is disappointing for a whole other amount of reasons, I think I'm leaning Pulisic here, even though I am a big Luka guy. Pulisic has the potential to change how an entire country feels about a sport that they've pretty much ignored for the last 40 or 50 years. So I have to give him the edge there in terms of bigger icon.
And I don't know, Ben. I've heard Luka Doncic is really revolutionizing the Slovenian youth basketball scene.
I thought the Dragic brothers already did that.
Yeah. Zoran's a big culture Zoran. Up there. Yeah, no, I tend to agree with you. They're both making a massive impact.
Well, before the podcast, Gavin, you were laying down Pulisic and saying that.
No. Okay, let me give some context on that. All right, I'm not a big soccer fan, so I'd love for Ben to enlighten me on this front. But my understanding is Luka Doncic, considered quite possibly the greatest European basketball prospect of all time, while Pulisic is potentially far and away the best American of all time. But on the world stage, Ben, is he legitimately one of the 5 to 10 best players his age in the world right now?
Oh man, that's a tough one. I mean, in terms of him excelling at the World Cup as a teenager, I guess we will never find out, since it's going to be another 4 years until we see him. But there have been plenty of young teenagers or 21, 22-year-olds kind of go on to that big stage right away and excel like Messi among a million other people. So it's kind of tough when you put it in that light. But I think for a country that has never... I mean, look at all the failed American prospects that we've gone through over the years, whether it was Freddie Adu is probably the biggest one.
Is Freddie Adu the Kwame Brown of soccer?
I think he was even more hyped, relatively. I don't know. He was all over. I got into sports when I picked up a sports almanac in 2004, and he was all over it. So I was all in on Freddie Adu early.
I mean, people want to like soccer in this country, and we've been so painfully mediocre. Even the years that we made it into the knockout stages of the World Cup, it was basically fluky. I mean, Pulisic, even in qualifying, basically carried this old-ass U.S. men's national team to within a game of qualifying before they fell apart against Trinidad and Tobago. I think Pulisic is the real deal. It's probably a little iffier to, off the top of my head, say he's one of the top 5 or 10 prospects in the entire world, but I haven't seen a dude like Pulisic play soccer at this age this well in a long, long time.
All right, I'm definitely excited about him. All right, another quick hitter for you. I can right now wave my magic wand and give you a mulligan on the Allen Crabbe trade, knowing what you know now, and that in my humble opinion, Joe Harris has been essentially as good as him, if not better, at a much cheaper price. Do you take that away?
Oh man, I think I'm gonna say no, just because I have faith. You see the other moves that Sean Marks went out to do. He obviously gave Crabbe the big offer sheet 2 years ago. No, Crabbe, they might be a little slow in implementing him thus far, but given his track record, even with the difficulties of Sean Kilpatrick at this point, but he's hit on a lot of other guys that I do want to keep Crabbe, especially because, I mean, what Nicholson was a lost asset. The fact that we turned him into anything valuable that the Nets were going to use going forward is a miracle. I mean, he almost single-handedly brought the Nets back in that game against the Warriors. So I would hold on to Crabbe and just have faith in Marks and his plan.
Yeah, I think that for me, I personally would kind of do the trade over again. I know that what you're saying is it definitely makes sense, but at the same time, if the whole team was healthy, would you rather have, like, I would even rather have a 3-point guard lineup of Lynn, Dinwiddie, and Russell on the court at the same time closing games. Just a deep cut for our soccer fans and for you, Ben. Kind of like having Lacazette, Ozil, and I'm blanking on the other person.
But, not so deep a cut, Josh.
Oh my god. But it's basically like Wenger playing his three best players at the same time. So I wouldn't even have Crabbe as top six, top seven player on the Nets at this point. And I think that for that salary, I don't know how you can justify having him on the team. And I think that one of my big criticisms of Marks was that he didn't get more in that trade. Obviously, Nicholson was a lost cause, as you mentioned. But for me, it just doesn't seem like a great use of resources.
Yeah, not getting that pick or any pick at all. I don't remember. Was it ever discussed that there was... I don't think the Blazers ever had a pick on the table, right?
Yeah. I think we were the only ones discussing it.
Yeah. I mean, his defense still leaves a lot to be desired, although there aren't a lot of people on the Nets, frankly, that fall into that above-average defender category anyways. I know Joe Harris's defense is pretty underrated, especially compared to Crabbe, so that's another point in Harris's corner. But I've liked what I've seen from Crabbe in small doses so far, the way that they use him in the offense, bringing him off of screens and kind of using him in that Korver light role that Atkinson did as an assistant with the Hawks a few years ago. And maybe that is the type of thing that you just need to develop over time as the offense figures out their kinks. And it also is probably a huge wrench, obviously, to lose Russell and Lynn and all the stuff that they worked on through the preseason and training camp. But I'm not ready to give up on Crabbe, I think.
Okay, moving on to another player that is very divisive among Nets fandom, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson. What have you thought of his kind of skill development this year, and how do you see his career progressing moving forward now that it seems like he's changed who he is as a player and more of an offensive scorer type?
I love Rondae. I've been a big Rondae guy from day one. I think now that Lopez is gone, he's probably my favorite player to watch on the Nets just because he has figured out how to develop his game, even though it looks like he may not ever be much of a jump shooter. I know last year they tried to stick him at the four a lot to try and get him closer looks to the hoop, and that's worked. But as I said, there are a few above average defenders on this team, and Rondae Hollis-Jefferson is by far the best Nets defender. So even when he's not scoring well, he's a delight to watch defensively. His steals, his closeout blocks. Rondae has been fun, and I'm glad to see him take that step this year because a lot of people were ready to give up on him, maybe get whatever they could in the offseason for a trade. But I don't know if Rondae will ever be a star, but if this Nets team can stay healthy for a long period of time, I think he easily could be that third or fourth piece that chips in a little bit everywhere along the way on a deeper team that is in playoff contention. So I've been very pleased with Rondae's development this year.
Yeah, I'm absolutely stunned with what we've seen from him on offense. I remember me and Josh sitting down watching him in summer league. It was kind of the first sustained period of time I really spent watching him since he was in college at Arizona. And he looked like he was trying to push the limits of his game and extremely unsuccessfully. He was trying to throw these like full court bounce passes and they were like flying and like hitting fans and stuff. And basically he was like just endangering people around the court. And now he's suddenly this coordinated, aggressive guy who takes advantage of every single mismatch, is shooting 15 footers with confidence. I've seen very few guys kind of make the jump that he has this offseason. And yeah, I totally agree with you. I think he's an essential part of the team. All right, so Ben, we'll send you out with this. I think it's a tradition at this point. We've only had about two guests on this podcast, you and Nets broadcaster Ryan Rucco.
You're in good company, Ben.
Yeah, great company. Like, except for the fact that I think he only has one Who Am I win that he just picked up this weekend.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
He's struggling this year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so still, good company, nonetheless. Yeah, so the one thing we were asking both of you, and I think anyone who comes on this podcast that covered the Nets in the early 2010s, what's your favorite Brook Lopez story from your time covering the team?
Oh, man. So I did a little bit of research on this one, and what I basically found is that I will stand for anything that Brook Lopez has ever done or said. A lot of his interests align with me, his big Star Wars fandoms. I know his obsession with Disneyland has been amazing. I love the fact that he had an Instagram for his cat years before he ever had his own. And it seems like he begrudgingly got one. I love his relationship with Robin Lopez, all the ongoing mascot battles. But the one that I think I went back to, I found an old Nets Daily post. And it was from 2015 when Robin was on the Trailblazers and he came to town and they ended up going to McDonald's at 2:30 in the morning. They said that they had a curfew, so they had to sneak out of the house, that he paid for the meal because Robin is cheapskate, and that Lopez ate two filet of fishes at 2:30 in the morning. Just because that's what they do as twins, as weird little, I don't know, they're NBA staples at this point.
Yeah, if they were like another set of twins, the Morai brothers, then they would just need to pay from the same bank account, so.
Yeah, I mean, I gave it a lot of thought, and I racked my brain, and I think I would get behind anything that Brook Lopez ever did or said, and not to mention he carried some really bad and boring Nets teams throughout the year and often did it with a smile. And then to be such a pleasant, fun, off-the-court guy just made him a guy that I think fans really invested in over the years and helped them get through those tough times. So I'm one of the biggest Brook Lopez fans you will have.
Yeah, I'm completely with you there. Probably my favorite Nets player of all time. And I think one of the saddest parts is just knowing his personality, that once he does retire, he's kind of going to be out of the public spotlight. He's not the type of player to go into broadcasting or media or anything like that. So I feel like we need to cherish Brook Lopez while he's still in the league.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some, I guess it's died down a little bit now, but fans were a little bit upset, I guess a certain subsection of them on Twitter, that he didn't take out a full page to thank the fans after he got traded, but I have no ill will towards Brook Lopez at all, given the loyalty that he gave to the franchise and often didn't get back with the years of trade rumors. And if he, for some reason, wanted to come back this summer, I think everyone would welcome him back with open arms.
Yeah, Ben, given that you mentioned Star Wars, I'll throw one Brook Lopez story back at you that we got from Ryan Rucco. Did you know that he actually didn't want to see the new movie last year? Or no, 2 years ago. He didn't want to see Force Awakens.
I vaguely recall that, but did he have a reason why?
He thought it would ruin the originals, even though you could argue that they were already ruined with the prequels. But so what ended up happening was like Ryan Rucco was like distraught at this because he's apparently extremely invested in Brook Lopez's enjoyment of Star Wars, as we all are as Nets media people. And he had Ryan Anderson, when they went to play the Rockets, convince him to go see it. So then Brook, I think, went with Ryan, and they went and saw it together, two Pacific Northwest guys, and apparently they enjoyed it.
Didn't he petition to be like a stormtrooper or a Wookiee for years and years, right?
I think so, yeah. I don't know if that ever came to fruition, though.
Oh, I hope someday, even if after he retires, he just kind of spends his time in mascot character at Disneyland or something like that, and no one will ever know it's him, but he'll have the time of his life. That seems like a fitting ending for Brook Lopez.
I don't know. That could potentially be kind of tragic because if Robin accidentally stumbles upon him, he might attack him not knowing that it's
his
brother.
That's a great point. Great point.
All right. We really appreciate it, Ben. Do you have anything to plug or anything to share out? I know people can obviously find you at Basketball Insiders and at, I believe, Ben_Netto on Twitter.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, two underscores. One underscore was taken, unfortunately.
Oh,
so that's,
no. That's
two underscores there. But
yeah, I appreciate
no,
it.
not too much to plug other than that. But thank you for having me on. It was a blast.
All right. Really appreciate it, Ben. We'll be sure to have you back.
All right. So that wraps up this edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. Big thanks to Ben for taking the time to come on to the show. Shout out to Josh for being a great co-host, as always. We'll be back later in the week with a recap of the Nets win over the Dallas Mavericks. Until then, peace out.